and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng. And today we're going to play the virtual version of the InfoSec extension pack of Cards Against Humanity. So experts, introduce yourselves, and the prompt is blank is now included for free with every OS update.
Hi, this is Mike Buckby, and I'm going to choose a mouse-connected serial to PS2 to USB is now included with every OS update.
Hi, this is Killian, and I'm going to choose RM-RF/ is now included with every new version of the OS.
This is Mike Thompson, and I am going to choose a webcam pointed at the coffee maker is now included with every update.
Ooh, I like the webcam pointed at the coffee maker. Because that's actually secretly for Mike, because I know how much he likes his coffee.
It's true.
So if you want an actual deck of these cards, Mike, he created these cards. There are 72 in a deck. Please go to iTunes and leave us a rating for the Inside Out Security Show, and we'll put you in the running for a deck of these cards. And to learn more on how to do this, please visit veronis.com/review. And on to today's show. So it's such a coincidence that we're going to refer to a lot of what happened in the last episode, because I think what we're seeing is that notion that hackers and the bad guys, they're always one step ahead. And it just feels like this is coming true, like after a week, but they're just really just articles that we find. So last week we talked about cardless ATMs, and this week it feels like it doesn't even matter if they're cardless ATMs, because there have been a few stories about getting through the physical security of ATMs where they send commands to trigger cash to be dispensed. And the only kind of alert that would happen would be when the ATM's computer notices the cash dispenser acting independently and then it reboots. When that happens, the thieves, they can extract thousands of dollars before it starts happening all over again. And then in contrast to this bank story, there are hackers where they change the DNS registrations and a whole bunch of banks' online properties, and then the attackers get control of their online operations for a couple of hours. And what's really mind-blowing is that the hijack is so good that the bank can't even send an email to their customers to alert them about this problem. So security experts, walk us through the differences between the attacks and what you make of them.
Really, really interesting banking articles. The first one, the one about the ATMs, I thought was really kind of particularly interesting. These ATMs we see all over the place. And the funny thing is, kind of in the security world, we always have to operate under the notion that if an attacker gets physical access to a machine, they can own it, and that's it. There's pretty much nothing you can do. But we go around and we put these, you know, ATM machines, which are basically just computers, all over the place with physical access. Now, with them, you know, they try and limit the input. You know, you can put your card in, you can put your keypad in. But what these attackers did is they realized that it's very easy to circumvent a lot of the kind of external protections in a way by simply drilling a little hole. And once they do that, they can just connect to the board inside and run malicious code on them to kind of get it, the system to do it at once. And this is not something that this particular ATM vendor thought about, because there's basically no authentication between the different modules in the system. So, you know, the keypad and the cash dispensing portion. And the communications between them are not encrypted either, or very minimally encrypted. So once the attacker is able to connect to that internal port there, they can issue a command and get it to do whatever it wants. So that's kind of really interesting that they're exploiting this, you know, physical connection. And it just highlights that security has to be in depth. There has to be multiple layers of security. In this case, you can't rely completely on physical security, because once you kind of get past the, you know, hard plastic shell on the outside, it's very, very easy to inject commands to get the machine to spit out money.
Yeah, I think, you know, most of our customers and most people listening to this probably aren't managing a network of ATM machines. So if there's a lesson to take from it, I think it is that, you know, physical security is very important. But probably a better one is actually that really it's this diagnostic backend keys, that they're connecting to a serial port and then able to run all these commands. And you think of that as something helpful, like, oh, there's this support mechanism. But that's a very common thing in lots of different scenarios where it's this like out of band support help remote system that's really vulnerable that isn't what you normally think of. So yeah, very interesting. Also, I like that they put a sticker over the hole to like hide their stuff. Like I just imagine the criminal meetings were like, what kind of sticker should we put over this hole? Like, you know, a skateboarding one or like a Hello Kitty. Like it's very important.
I mean, I think this is an impressive attack against this ATM, but it definitely took some very specific knowledge. I don't think this is something run-of-the-mill criminal would be able to execute. I mean, whoever did this had specific knowledge of that model of ATM. They knew where that port was. They knew how to access it. You know, they had probably been maybe, you know, done some sort of diagnostics on this particular model before. So I don't know if it's necessarily a widespread vulnerability, but like Killian said, if you have access, if you have physical access to the machine, you know, there's only so much you can do to protect it. So this seemed very targeted and maybe not something that's going to be a widespread vulnerability for every ATM nationwide.
I mean, this just makes me think of it. And actually, you made a great point there. It made me think of the episode a couple weeks ago now where we talked about the slot machine vulnerability against the same type of situation. The criminals were able to get their hands on an old slot machine and figure out a timing attack against it. Again, seems like very similar. They got their hands on one of these pretty common ATMs and were able to reverse engineer a lot of it.
Yeah, it sounded like what happened is it happened to a bank and they couldn't prevent it and they had to take it to the security researchers to figure out how it happened. But actually, while I was preparing for this show, I was thinking about actual bank robberies. And even though these stories are terrifying and it's unfortunate for the bank, I'm glad that it doesn't involve like actual bank customers, because I was in a bank robbery many, many years ago, and I didn't like how they didn't check in with the customers to see if they were okay. I didn't even get anything complimentary, like not even points.
They didn't give you like one of those lollipops they give you at the teller window or anything like that?
There was no lollipop, no water. I didn't think that they did enough to ensure that customers feel safe banking at that location in the future. So I'm kind of glad that this is all online. This is all at an ATM. Bad for the bank, but good for actual real humans.
Now, Cindy, were you involved in the bank robbery, or were you involved in the bank robbery?
Hey.
I'm just saying, no. If it was a later one, you could have taken all the lollipops you wanted.
I guess, but there could have been other easier ways to get lollipops. The responsibility is on the bank in terms of figuring out their security, and I'm glad they're taking the steps to do so. And speaking of responsibility, what do you guys think about the latest article of Let's Encrypt, where they issue SSL certificates, but a lot of them are to phishing sites, and they can't just revoke the certificates because in the article, and it says that they don't think that it's their problem. And there's a lot going on in this article, and you guys recently just said in the last episode, just because your browser says secure, it doesn't really mean that it's secure, but that's the new normal. What is a good way to approach and think about the remarks presented in this article?
Well, the one thing that I'd like to just kind of mention too is the connection between these two articles that we kind of found independently. So the attack against the bank website, where the attackers basically were able to compromise DNS records and redirect all the internet traffic to amazing-looking phishing sites where they siphoned off the customer information, did have security certificates from Let's Encrypt. So they were able to take advantage of this free service that arguably is doing a great thing by helping people secure their websites, but the attackers are taking advantage as well too. So the end users, they see secure on their web browser, they see this secure, you know, green padlock on the bank website and say, oh, it must be the bank. We've kind of trained users to look for this at this point, but the system, like so many systems, was never designed to take into account this sort of abuse. So that's a very good example of this type of situation in practice. The customers of the bank that were exploited presumably were at least somewhat aware, hopefully they were aware, that the website said secure, but the fake phishing site was good enough and it had an SSL certificate, which they've been kind of trained to look for, and I know we harp on this quite a bit, to look for that. So it was a kind of very sophisticated in that sense. The other half of the argument, and I'm looking at Mike, and I'll give you a chance to jump in here, Mike, is that it is arguably doing a great service, but it's all a matter of trust. They're issuing these certificates that we're supposed to, again, trust the security of them. But there, in my opinion, should be some stronger controls around vetting. I'm pushing it off to the, you know, browser vendors and things like that is not the right answer. And part of the article talked about, I think it was hundreds or thousands of SSL certificates being issued to websites with PayPal in the title, for example. That just seems like it's a very, very easy thing to catch, even without investing a lot of time in the process. And maybe they're right. Maybe it's not entirely their problem, but it seems like it's a very easy step to take to avoid some of these types of attacks.
Let's Encrypt is interesting in that it really relies upon the central notion of if you control the DNS for a domain, that you should be able to immediately get an SSL certificate for it. And that's it. That's like their beginning and their end of their thought. And what Let's Encrypt replaced is a lot of the more traditional certificate authorities. And the more traditional certificate authorities were doing exactly what you described, Killian, which is that they have a whole series of checks and whitelists and looking for certain terms. Like, it was almost a joke that they were so strict in that if you tried to register a site with the word book in the domain to get an SSL cert for it, they would reject it and then manually verify that you were actually trying to get something real, because there were so many attempts to create Facebook credential stealing websites for spammers that it was just necessary to do that. And while an imperfect system and a system that occasionally had issues, it was sort of, you know, the best system in place. And now Let's Encrypt has come along and said, like, oh, we're going to do something very different and really do away with the notion that there should be, the certificate authorities should be messing with the desires of the site owners. And that's a lot of the rhetoric I see around it, but it's distressing that, you know, there isn't a better thing to be done. And I think where this is going is that what we haven't said is sort of the different levels of SSL certificates, where there's DV, domain validated certificates, and there's EV, the extended validated certificates. And they have a different look in the browsers. It's not just a green lock. It's, you know, it says the company name, and there's a lot more about it for the EV. And I think that's where we're going to go, that everything is just going to be domain validated, and it's going to look normal, not having an SSL certificate is going to look red and insecure on the browser, and having an EV certificate is going to be for sites that we, you know, a year or so ago would have considered needing SSL, sites that take credit cards and passwords and everything else, that each of these would serve a different function. But we're not there today.
Okay.
Well, I was going to say,
go ahead.
There was the talk about who was responsible for this with the banks. The bank in Brazil that had their DNS taken over, that turned into a much more serious issue, because they were immediately able to literally like have a script that runs and issues a new SSL certificate for those sites the instant that they took over, which is a new sort of thing. And it's an interesting piece of this, in that you're saying, well, is the bank responsible for this, or is the registrar responsible for this? And it's one of those very difficult situations where everyone is sort of responsible for it. And I think in general, DNS is underestimated as an attack vector for websites.
Our next piece that we're going to talk about, Android overtakes Windows as the internet's most used operating system. So I'm thinking, now that we mobile bank, are Androids going to be responsible in the future? Because mobile is super important today. When I went to Black Hat last year, the mobile security class, that seminar, it was totally overbooked. People were sitting on the floor to learn more, and people were just really eager to figure it out. What are some responsible security things to think about when it comes to mobile security?
I think Android specifically is kind of a unique challenge, because of the relationship between the development of Android as an operating system and then these different variations that get sent out, you know, by service providers and, you know, phone companies and manufacturers. So, you know, a lot of times Android developers will identify security flaw and they'll patch it, they'll upgrade it, they'll release a new version of Android, but it takes, HTC or whoever, or AT&T, whoever's making these custom builds of Android for their devices, they can't necessarily integrate that quickly. You know, there's been, you know, new Android devices that never get the newest version, the actual operating system. You know, they stay one or two versions behind. So Android's quickly become like the by far the largest mobile market share, and now a browser on the internet. So there's millions of these devices around the world, and I question how many of them are even remotely up to date in terms of, you know, security updates via Android, and how many are just kind of lagging years behind. And there's really no method to patch these old devices.
Yeah, this one struck a little bit close to home. I love the Google services, and I think what Google is doing with Android is fantastic. And just kind of their approach as a company to security, I think, is really beneficial. But it is disconcerting that a lot of the decisions around security and patching are pushed off to the, you know, handset vendors or the service providers. In that article Mike sent, a lot of people were comparing it to Microsoft of, you know, the 90s, where they were so ubiquitous and there were so many security issues. And I think the analogy falls apart very quickly, though, because Microsoft did control the operating system. They weren't sourcing it out to have third parties provide their own versions of it. So the control and the processes were much easier to implement in terms of patching and deploying the patches. On a, you know, on a personal level, I actually recently ditched one of my Android phones for a Pixel for a couple of reasons. But one is that, you know, when I bought the phone, it had a lot of great features. It was at a great price point. And they had made promises that they would keep it up to date and patched consistently. And I thought that was great. You know, I can get the phone I want, the features I want, and still be able to maintain that security, because that's a big concern for me. And they managed to get out one update. I think they went from Lollipop to, what was it, Marshmallow, I guess, within a reasonable amount of time. But they completely dropped the ball. They haven't even attempted to go to Nougat at this point. And I think I got maybe one or two security patches half a year after they were released by Google. And I thought that was unacceptable. And I won't name the name of the company, but selling your product on the fact that, hey, we're not Google, but we're going to deliver these services, I think is incredibly disingenuous. And I think users need to start holding the handset manufacturers more accountable and saying, listen, we want these updates. You can't just kind of dump a new phone on us every 6 months and not provide support for the old ones, especially when it comes to security. As Cindy said, because we're relying on it more and more for secure portions of our life, like banking.
I guess that's the real difference to me, is that I think it's a situation where, as a consumer, there's very little leverage and very little that you can do with respect to your phone if you want to actually keep it secure, that you're entirely at the mercy of these much larger ecosystems that have a very different set of priorities. And I'm not sure there's a good solution to it. I wonder if it's actually driving something more like every phones are getting cheaper and cheaper. What if it's something where, like, every year you just get a new phone? Every 6 months you just get a new phone.
That's what they want you to do.
Well, I wonder if that's part of it. Like, part of the reason is like, oh, you should upgrade to get all this stuff, and that, you know, the new versions have more features, that they have more issues. It's just a mess. And I think that really is the difference, that there's very little choice and there's very little that can be done. I don't think there's any advice you can give, like, oh, you have a 2-year-old Android phone that hasn't been updated. The only reasonable advice is, oh, you should stop using that and get a new phone. I don't think there's, you know, any combination of software and updates that you can really do that would help. Obviously, you could jailbreak it and maybe replace the whole OS yourself, but even that's not possible in a lot of cases. And it's far beyond what I think you can expect, and just a person who just wants to use their phone to do.
And that's something I was going to bring up. And, you know, coming from the security world and IT world, like, I see discussions about new devices and people just say, oh, it doesn't matter what operating system comes on it, because I'm going to flash it with a vanilla distribution of Android anyways. But obviously, that's not something that the average consumer can do. I'm wondering if there needs to be a method for that to be more accessible to the average person, where they don't have to initially jump through a bunch of hoops to put a vanilla distribution of Android that's going to be updated regularly. Instead, they can, you know, run a quick utility and replace whatever custom OS they have, you know, with this more regularly updated version direct from Google.
And I'd love to see if Google takes a little bit more of an active part in it to kind of maybe in, I know, you know, Android, anybody can use it. It's kind of the benefit of it and why it's so widespread. But I'd love if Google kind of stepped into these other providers and handset makers and said, hey, listen, you guys have to at least implement some security patch in a reasonable time frame, because they're pretty good at calling out other vendors about security holes that they discover by the research team. It's just a little bit odd that they don't call out, you know, I'm going to pick on Samsung, but just because they're a big vendor, and say, hey, you guys haven't updated to whatever or pushed this patch. Not that they'd really sit there and monitor it, but I think they have a little bit of influence to change things for the better.
Well, it's interesting. So we talked about Let's Encrypt as well. I feel there is some sort of level of theoretical or research-oriented security that takes place in a vacuum that's separate from real world in terms of how, like, it's one thing to find a zero day. Like, that's a big issue. It's another thing to make a patch for it. It's yet another thing to then distribute that to, you know, 20 million people. And there needs to be some sort of thought along that entire spectrum. In the same sort of way, there needs to be some sort of thought along the spectrum of, like, well, yes, more SSL certs are better than fewer SSL certs, but they still need to mean something, and there still needs to be some thought in there along the whole way.
Does it mean something that every week Killian sends me an article about a smart device and now there's a problem with it? So now that mobile devices are here to stay, we should also accept that smart devices are here as well. And I love talking about it with you guys every week. Killian found an article about how you can experience an exploit attack through your smart TV through an over-the-air signal that, and you wouldn't even notice it. So is this a really good PSA for people who have smart TVs? I actually don't really care because I don't have a TV. But, you know, a TV is kind of a big deal for a lot of people. Well, what are some of your responses to this piece and the overall smart TV space?
Well, first off, you know, every week on the show, Cindy, I'd like to send you a new one of these articles just because, you know, I hope after our listeners listen, they become paranoid of a new device in their house every day, you know. They can't have private phone calls by their dishwasher anymore. You know, they better stay away from their smart TV because it's hacked and spying on them. So, you know, just bringing a little bit more paranoia to every room in the house. That's my gift to the world.
I was going to say every week, Killian just sends me a new item on his Amazon wish list with, like, hint, hint, like, this is something I want.
Ooh, I'm going to start thinking about what I want.
Teslas. But it was an interesting article. It's just, again, a new kind of attack vector. We've talked a lot about smart TVs and other smart devices. This one, at least folks listening in North America, don't have to worry about right now. In that particular over-the-air attack, it takes advantage of different broadcast technologies that are not used in North America right now, different standards, because we use ATSC. But it's just another interesting attack vector that we're digitalizing a lot of things. And it's being interpreted by a computer at the other end. Kind of going back to some of the things that we talked about with Let's Encrypt, it was never designed with abuse in mind. So, you know, the smart TV manufacturers didn't sit down and think, well, what if somebody did this? You know, they thought, how can I deliver a service to our customers? How can I give them more information about the program that they're watching? As opposed to, could this, you know, be exploited somehow or buffer overflow in the system to take control of the actual device and make it, you know, part of a botnet or something like that? And it's not something I don't think is very widespread, not necessarily at least in North America. It's mostly a proof of concept, but it's just another kind of highlight to the fact that we have all of these devices that are computers all over the place in our house, connected to the internet, and they're being manufactured by people who are not necessarily technology companies in the sense of software companies or operating system companies.
What really kind of amazed me about this article was that these TVs aren't even necessarily connected to the internet. Like, I have a smart TV, but I don't use any of the functionality. It's just that dumb TVs don't really exist anymore. So when I got a new TV a couple months ago, I bought a smart TV. I don't have it hooked up to the internet, but if I had a digital receiver and I was getting over-the-air broadcasts, I could still be susceptible to this. So, you know, it's the fact that there's a computer, there's an operating system running on my TV that's really the issue. Even though I necessarily have it connected it to the internet, you know, I could still be vulnerable. Obviously not because of the whole I'm in North America thing. We don't use that type of broadcast. But still, you know, this is a smart device that doesn't necessarily have to be connected to the internet to be vulnerable.
Well, the term I would use is surface area, that suddenly you have this much greater surface area for attack for these TVs, where you have commands that are coming in from the web browser that's built into the TV, from the apps that are on it, from an over-the-air digital broadcast. And this seemed like something that mixed together elements of all of that. And in particular, like we're mentioning with the ATMs, like, oh, they got access to the serial port and some of the diagnostic pieces. This sounds like it might actually be part of the same thing, where an over-the-air signal triggers a command that does some sort of update or something else. And it almost does sound like a movie, like, oh, when the World Cup's on and everyone's watching it, you know, over the digital broadcast, and then someone drives around in a radio truck and takes over all the TVs to, you know, show their things.
Speaking of World Cup, it reminds me of the team that did win. They used big data. And these days, a lot of people are using wearables. A lot of sporting venues and teams are using them, especially with smart textiles. I've never even heard of it. But they're trying to make a connection between, because people are using wearables and using big data, and they're trying to implement technology and to create smart textiles. My mind vacillates between thinking of like a headline where a sports team uses wearable and then they're accused of digital doping or electronic doping. Or I think of also like the Karate Kid, when the main character, his knee was hurt, and then the bad guy, like the sensei, told him to hurt his knee to take his opponent down. Like, that goes through my mind, and certain countries can win like Olympics because of it. Or then I'm just like thinking about robotics and like the Terminator. My imagination is going wild. What were you guys thinking when you read the phrase smart textiles?
I don't know about you, but I immediately went to put him in a body bag, Johnny. So that was what I was thinking.
Sweep the leg.
Sweep the leg, put him in a body bag.
Well, Cindy, at the end of the show, I think everyone's going to be afraid of their television and now their T-shirts, too, that they're spying on them. But I don't think I need smart textiles to tell anybody that I eat too many tacos. It's, you know, maybe that's Mike's what's the harm lesson from this one.
What's interesting to me about this is that it reads a lot like science fiction. And, you know, the best science fiction has always been, you know, a reflection and sort of like trying an extension of our current times. And like, what are we going to see? And there's a lot of science fiction that kind of tries to think about like, well, what happens when every computer is the size of a grain of dust and that, you know, it's just floating around constantly? And how do you deal with that? And how do you think about it? And this is sort of one more tiny step towards that sort of world where electronics are cheaper. There's even more surface area for all this stuff. And, you know, in the same way that Thompson was talking about, like, oh, it's almost impossible to get a TV that's not smart now because it's like a dollar a chip to throw in the TV. Eventually, textiles are all going to have these things in them because it's like a nickel. And so, you know, why wouldn't you have all these, you know, things available? Like, why not?
Oh, this material feels good against my skin. I would want to buy more of these. Which companies sell these? That's something I actually think of. I might be in the market for smart textiles. What's going on in Mike's corner this week?
This week, I wanted to share a tool called Ngrok, N-G-R-O-K, and easy thing to do is just Google it. What it does is it lets you move and interact with ports locally and across the web, and it's a hugely useful diagnostic tool for all sorts of stuff. That if you're writing a script and you want to, you know, try it, or you want to try to redirect certain traffic into it, all of these things are made possible with it, and then you can, you know, inspect it and play around with it. So a great free tool for anyone to use, a free service technically, and would recommend checking it out. So Ngrok.
Thanks, Mike Buckby, Killian Engler, Mike Thompson, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you want to follow us on Twitter to find some of the stories we're discussing, you can find us at infosec_podcast. Thanks, guys, and we'll meet up again next week.
Thanks,
everyone.
Bye, Cindy.